fall, I believe. That sounds about right. I hope it wasn't anything I did.
It was, but I assure you that I am content with my place. I'm still on the coast of Normandy, near where we last met, sipping from the wine-infused blood of the French. I like to drink from the people who drink Pinot Noir's best delicious bouquet.
I'm happy for you. But since you're so content and unfettered by obligation, you should have no problem telling me where to find Theophilus.
Only the problem of uncertainty. He does not keep me apprised of his movements now that I am out of favor.
Give me a guess, or tell me who can point me to him.
I am truly severed from reliable associates, alas. My best guess is that you will find him in Prague at the moment.
Big city, Leif. Where in Prague?
The Grand Hotel Bohemia is his favorite. Heavy curtains on the windows and scrupulous attention to guest privacy. This had better not be a setup, Leif.
It is,
as I said, only a guess.
Act on it or not,
as your conscience dictates.
Oh, I would act on it, all right. I'd leave Fragra with Ty and Sam, and take the new stake with me, and act on it with gusto. Enjoy your Pinot blood,
I said,
and ended the call with my thumb.
Chapter 15. It's been too long since I've had any sleep. Greta wouldn't let me, until she was sure I'd handled the concussion, so it's dark by the time my vision and thoughts clear up. She takes me to one of those hospitals, like Sheahan was in, and runs me through all these machines that can take pictures of your insides without cutting through the outside. By that time I'd had enough help from Gaia to set me brain right, so the doctor says, nope, Mr. Kennedy is not concussed, but that left shoulder is a mite dodgy, ain't it? He introduces himself as Dr. Sudarga, and he smells like he's fond of vanilla soap. Greta tells me later that his name indicates he's from a place called Indonesia, or anyway, his family was generations ago. He shows me x-rays and points out all the fractures and muscle tears and whatnot. And I think it's pretty helpful. Seeing the image gives me focus on what to fix, and that'll make me healing more efficient. Great, I says. I'll get right on that.
I beg your pardon. How are you getting on it?
Apparently I say the wrong feckin' thing, and Greta hurries to explain.
He means he'll rest and follow your instructions to the letter.
Not if it includes taking drugs, I says, and Greta sighs and puts her face in her hand. I give the idea that I'm supposed to do whatever Dr. Sudarga says. His eyes shift back and forth between me and Greta.
If you don't want any pain meds, that's of course your decision,
he says.
But we really need to immobilize that shoulder.
Try it, and I'll immobilize you, lad.
Owen,
Greta exclaims. What? We don't need instructions or anything else. I do understand that I've been rude somehow, so I turn to the doctor and try to let him down easy. Dr. Sudarga, thank you kindly for showing me that picture of me bones, but I don't want to take up any more of your time. All I want now is a shot of whiskey and a bed.
If we don't immobilize that shoulder, your muscles might not reattach correctly, and you could be looking at permanent damage. It's likely you'll need surgery.
It's not likely at all. I told you, I'm on it, and it'll heal up just fine. He blinks and looks at Greta.
If he leaves without treatment, I'm not responsible.
This is such an obvious statement that I don't know why he wastes breath on it. May harmony find ye, I says, and I leave the room. I hear Greta apologizing to him, which I don't think is necessary. And I get a fine long lecture afterward about how strange behavior like that is going to get written down and remembered and maybe invite official scrutiny. The better thing to do would have been to let him put me in a sling and then take it off as soon as we left. If we never go see a doctor again, then we don't have to pretend like that, I says. Look, it's feckin' done already. We were there all night to find out that I'm not concussed and my shoulder's rubbish, which I already knew when I went in.
I wanted to confirm your head was all right, and that was the only way to do it. The Tempe Pack has a doctor in it, and he knows about our unusual healing. With everyone else, we have to make allowances.
Maybe they can allow me to take care of myself, I grumble.
So ornery. If you hadn't already had your ass kicked, I'd kick it for you.
I know. Sorry, love. I'm just worried about Fand, and I want to see if I can find out where that troll came from.
You have the apprentices to teach this morning.
But I don't think it's safe to roam around the property yet until I shut down that troll's path to me grove. Will he take a walk with me into the woods to look for it after I focus a bit on me shoulder?
Sure.
Once we're back at the house, I take time to reconnect with the earth, bind those tiny fractures together, and make sure the muscles are attached properly. They'll need time to rebuild before I can use the arm, but once I'm satisfied that the foundation is set, I use that trick Sheehan taught me to ease the pain and let the healing continue on its own as I walk. I slip me knuckles on as a precaution. No telling what we might find up there in the Ponderosa Pines. We don't have many evergreens in Ireland, and the smell is still something new to me nose. I like this forest, and the crunch of the needles underfoot, the skittering noise of a kicked pinecone, and the chattering of squirrels. Greta's walking on me right side, her breath steam in the air. And it's a bracing winter morn.
Or near enough. It'll be solstice before we know it.
She grins at me, and feels lovely enough to grab me hand and squeeze it.
Feeling better?
She asks. A bit, I have to admit. Trees are always the cure for your modern bollocks.
How do we find where the troll arrived?
We can either track it by smell, because by all the drunken gods that lad had a powerful scent, or I might get lucky and be able to spot the path in the magical spectrum.
Smell would probably be faster,
she says. Why? When we find where the trail ends, that's where he emerged, and then I can either untether the tree or figure out how to destroy the old way.
How are they different?
Kind of like the difference between a private and a public road. Only druids can use tethered trees freely, because we're bound to Gaia. Lesser fae can use some of them, but have trouble bringing other people along. Old ways, though, built by the Tua de Danann, are like your highways. Anyone can travel them, no magical ability required, except maybe having some way to see the path. That's what I think we're looking for. Trolls can't use the tethers to Tir na n'Og unless a druid shifts with them. Good thing, too. Last thing we need are trolls swinging their cocks all around the world.
Well, you can't follow a scent trail the way you are, and if you shapeshift, you're liable to mess up your shoulder even worse, aren't you? So that means I should probably play the bloodhound.
She sheds her jacket and drops it to the forest floor. What? No, you don't have to go through that. I'll shapeshift and it'll be fine. I'll walk on three legs, keep healing and everything. Greta spins in a circle, scanning the area.
It's no trouble, Owen. Look, we're already deep enough into the trees that no one from the house will see anything.
Her hands cross over her stomach, grab the bottom of her shirt, and pull it over her head in a fluid motion. I don't give a loud, juicy shite if anyone sees ye. I begin to unbutton my shirt as fast as I can with one hand. I don't want ye to have to go through the pain of the shift when ye don't have to.
That's sweet, Owen,
she says, tossing her shirt to the ground on top of her jacket and reaching for the fly of her jeans. But I stopped fearing the pain a long time ago. It can't be avoided, so I just accept it as part of my day. But this can be avoided, Greta. I told you I'd do it. No. Shh. She puts a finger to her lips and then points uphill, her eyes focused on something over my left shoulder. I turn and see a blue-skinned troll stepping from behind a pine onto the hill. He hasn't seen us yet. He's motioning to someone unseen, who becomes seen shortly thereafter. Another troll, this one with brown leathery skin, stepping from behind a tree that's not wide enough to hide their bulk. It's the anchored endpoint of an old way. They're coming through from one of the Irish plains. I start tearing at me clothes now. Feckin' stew me bullocks in the Queen's own cup of tea. The bastard had friends. We'll keep him busy while you're making the change. I say, since her shift takes much longer than mine. Two more trolls step through. And if you can call anyone else to help through your pack link, we could probably use it. She nods and continues undressing. As soon as I'm free of my clothes, I shift a bear and charge up the knuckles. Greta's bones start to slide and pop, and that draws the troll's attention. There are six of them, bunched together now, and I roar as I head uphill to face them in an awkward three-legged lope. Two of them have actual weapons, and the other four scurry about to find some, which means they pull up trees. One wraps his arms around the tree anchor in the old way, and another slaps him in the back of the head before he can uproot it.
No, not that one. We need it. Too big, anyway,
he says. And by that time, I'm closing fast on the first blue troll. Unlike the bog troll from yesterday, he has his package securely wrapped. Bless him. But has instead decided to adorn himself with the skulls of his smaller victims and the teeth of larger ones. These are strung on ropes about his neck, and so he makes hollow clacking noises when he moves. All about showing off, this one. Has a fancy club that looks carved instead of simply pulled out of the earth. I watch him hold it over his shoulder, wait for the swing, and then, when it comes around to clock me, I rear up and meet it with me brass-coated claws. They punch through the wood and shatter it into splinters, leaving the troll with a handful of toothpicks, but no injuries. The leather-brown troll steps in and aims a kick at me from the left side, and of course he tags me in the lame shoulder and sends me tumbling across the hill in a new explosion of pain that pierces right through me nerve blocks and tears apart all the work I'd done to bind it together. Damn, but trolls are unfairly strong. I can almost hear Dr. Sudarga saying,
"I told you we should have immobilized it."
It would be smarter to fight in camouflage now, but Greta's not finished shifting yet. She's yelping and howling through the change, and a few of the trolls are wondering what that's all about. If they were released from Time Islands, like me, they wouldn't know anything about werewolves. They might be thinking she's a wounded animal right now, which I suppose she is, instead of an imminent threat. I don't want them paying too much attention to her, so I have to remain both visible and annoying. I lumber up on me three legs, charge back toward the blue lad, and with an assist from Gaia, leap up far higher than should be possible. A trick that finally gets Greta to stop calling me teddy bear and calling me air bear instead. Blue bones can't get out from underneath, and he throws up a forearm to block me attack. The brass claws shear right through his arm, rake down his chest, rip apart his skull necklaces, and then dig into his guts, pulling some of them out. He worries about putting them back in with his remaining hand after that, and I don't have to worry about him. I have five other trolls to worry about, because I've secured their undivided attention. Leather Lad has a real club, the other four have saplings. The guys with actual trees have to slam them overhead if they want to hit me. They can't swing in an arc to catch me because other trees get in the way. I can dodge them. It's Leather Lad I have to watch for. He's got a club with spikes on it, and if he connects, I'll have to go to that feckin' hospital again. He moves forward, growling, and I hobble in reverse, growling back. He lunges and swings the club in a long, sweeping arc, and I have to leap away and fall on me right side to dodge it, though it still clips me with one of the spikes and leaves a deep scratch. Bears are strong, but not terribly agile on the ground, so I'm vulnerable. He steps forward with a to take advantage, cocking his arm back for another swing, and the lads behind him are grinning and cheering him on, anticipating the kill. We're all surprised, but none more than Leather Lad, when Greta leaps at his unguarded neck, and her teeth sink in, taking him to the ground. When he hits the ground, her momentum carries her a bit beyond, but she never lets go of that throat, so she tears it out and takes it with her. She shakes the flesh a couple of times from side to side and then flings it away, showing lots of bloody teeth to the other trolls and barking an angry challenge at them.
"That's not a normal wolf,"
one of them observes. Quite the scholar for a troll.
"Not a normal bear, either. Animals shouldn't be able to do that to us."
"Ah, he's referring to the natural armor of troll skin. Well, werewolves shrug off magic, especially low-level stuff like armored hide, and Crania's brass knuckles represent far stronger magic than theirs. Far against two now. They're wary, strong, and slow. It occurs to me that I'm also strong and slow as I struggle to my feet. Greta, though, is faster than a bowel movement after eating a pound of dried figs. She's also much faster than a troll can think. She bunches her muscles and leaps forward, charging the nearest one, and he wastes precious time figuring out that he can't lift up a tree and smash her with it before she gets to him. So he lifts up the trunk end and hides behind it, effectively blocking Greta from reaching his throat. She bounces off, scurries behind him, and tears up the tendon behind his right ankle, the one that modern people named after some Greek warrior. The troll falls on his arse, and Greta makes sure she isn't underneath. The tree falls down on top of the troll, and while that doesn't do him terrible damage, it does mean his hands are busy trying to throw it off instead of protecting his throat. Greta tears it out for him, and then scampers away as another troll tries to pound her to jelly with his makeshift club. He misses and smashes his friend's face instead. I'm on the move, though still slow, but the remaining three trolls are not paying attention, because Greta is now far more dangerous in their eyes. They've all raised their clubs and are just waiting for Greta to move into smashing range. I'm so hobbled that I can probably do more good as a distraction than anything else, so I position myself behind them and roar as loudly as I can. Two of them are still mighty worried about Greta, but one looks around for me, and he's the one that Greta goes for. A couple of bounds and a leap, and she's flying at his throat. He catches on at the last split second, instinctively drops the tree, and just swipes at the air in front of his torso in a desperate attempt to ward off her attack. It works. His arm, almost club-like in itself, bats her aside, and she tumbles less than gracefully to the ground.
"Oh!"
One of them crows.
"Now we smash!"
But he is so very wrong. By choice, Greta's not a pack leader, but she has all the charisma of one. And in the absence of Sam and Ty, her wishes are paramount. Through the pack link, she called the parents of me apprentices and their translators, and they arrive in time to swarm the last three trolls and tear them up. A couple start to come for me. They're so excited they can't tell friend from foe right now. But they pull up short and turn their heads to Greta. She has them firmly under control. They return to finish off Blue Bones and make sure all the trolls are well and truly a buffet for vultures. It's awkward to stay in Bear Farm with me shoulder so messed up, so I shift back to human and yell about it because the pain gets amplified. An out-of-place bone shard can wind up somewhere tender during a shapeshift and make the problem worse. Still, that's 6 trolls down, and the kids were never threatened. I shout, "I love it when we kick arse together!" Greta shakes herself all over and lets her tongue loll out to the side in a canine smile. "I'm gonna get me clothes and check out that old way." She lifts her head a couple times in an approximation of a nod, and I pick me way downhill, wincing, trying to figure out how to get me cocked up shoulder bones back to playing nicely together again. It's gonna bother me a good while. Getting into me pants takes so long I don't bother with a shirt, and I just carry it with me. Greta's waiting by the tree the trolls appeared behind, and shifting back to human. I wait for the process to finish before I try talking to her. "Sheehan says that werewolves have trouble traveling the plains. Gunnar used to get powerful sick. The theory is that your protections against magic fight against the plane shifting and make you queasy, so it's best if I go alone."
"Careful,"
she says, still shuddering from the change. "I will be, and I'll be back as soon as I can manage." Flipping me vision to the magical spectrum, I can see the old way laid out before me, lit up like a trail of fireflies at dusk. 6 steps forward, turn right 3 steps, quick left and another left, then right, and with every step the cooling bodies and the pines fade, and the lush, eternal summer of Tir na n Og gets closer. When I reach the end, I find myself in a nondescript area of Tir na n Og. There are no helpful signs pointing me to Fand, nor any fae nearby that I can question about it. It's hidden perfectly because it's smack in the middle of nothing special. Cursing at the necessity to shift to a bear again, I shuck off me pants, shift, and follow the trail of troll stench down to the river. That means the trolls arrived by boat from elsewhere then. A dead end. But at least while I'm here, I can visit Fan's prison to see if she left any clues there, and maybe figure out how she escaped. Flidish and I put her on one of the Irish plains, seldom visited by the winged fae that adored her so much. It used to have a bonny name long ago, but now it's a lawless place they call the Badlands, where the trolls and fearbolgs and other assorted nasties have chosen to live. It's connected to Tir na n Og by a well-guarded old way. Popular wisdom holds that you follow the rules if you use it to enter Tir na n Og, and feck all the rules once you enter the Badlands. Lots of banditry and preying upon one another as soon as you set foot there. If you can make it through that, you tend never to come back again. Too much trouble to fight through. And the various beings live as hermits as much as possible, in jealously guarded territories. Flemish and I figured that if we hid Fand on that plain, far from the old way, no one would even find her, much less engineer her escape. Flemish crafted a new old way in secret, accessed by hidden cave entrances on either end, and then set what we thought were incorruptible guards on her. The cell she was in was dead material, all glass, and utterly disconnected from the earth. It hung from iron chains set in the ceiling of rock. To ensure she couldn't stretch out through that tenuous link and connect to the earth, we lined the ceiling with layers of hard plastic. Deprived of energy, she couldn't unbind anything to escape. Our guards were in iron armor to further discourage binding, and even had a hunk of cold iron to use as a talisman should they need it. She was to be given food, water, and anything she wanted to read, and that's all. She had a chamber pot and had to lock herself up in iron monocles if she wanted the guards to empty it. Imagine my surprise when I arrived at her secret prison to find her still in it. Why, look at the guards. 4 of them. And they're the same ones we originally set upon her. Nothing different there. But nothing about this happy scene matches with the fact that I have an old way leading to me grove, and a troll who as much as admitted Fand had helped him get there. It's been a while since I visited, lads. Anything to report? Anything unusual? The guards all tell me no. Fan stares at me from her cell, hatred burning in her eyes. And still blindingly beautiful, like ice crystals in the sun. She hasn't a stitch on her. When's the last time you emptied the chamber pot? I ask the guards.
Few days ago. She hasn't asked.
It gets me thinking. If that isn't really Fan, but an imposter, she wouldn't want to be chained up in iron. That would mess with the glamour.
Time to empty it, I'd say.
I go to the cell and tell her to chain herself up. She is slow to comply, but she does it, and there isn't a flicker of a change to her appearance.
Huh.
Either that really is her, or it's an exceptional illusion to withstand the touch of iron. Still, it can be done. An extra dose of caution is warranted.
Give me the hunk of cold iron, lads. I'm going in.
Fan's eyes widen somewhat when she sees me approach with the cold iron in me hand, but she says nothing. When I hunker down and stretch out with the iron to place it against her foot, she shrinks away. Come on now. I just want to make sure you're Fan. Are you someone who'd be killed by the touch of cold iron? She shakes her head no. Then let me do this, or I'll have the lads in here to immobilize you completely. She nods and gapes still as I touch the cold iron to her right foot. The skin shudders, then ripples, and our appearance changes as the glamour is dispelled, flowing up from the leg until I'm left with a human, but definitely not Fan. It's a rather ordinary-looking pale woman, with mussed dark hair and a large nose.
I figured, I says. Who are you then, since you aren't Fanned?
I'm a Selkie.
A Selkie?
That would make sense. Since they were one of the few kinds of lesser fae that weren't killed by cold iron, their human side protected them. But that pointed to a larger problem. One of Manannan's?
Aye.
He cast the seeming on you himself?
Aye.
Feckin' hells. I round on the guards. When was Manannan MacLear here? They exchange glances and say he never was there at all. I wince. Of course not. Then who was the last visitor?
Flitish was here a few days ago.
One says. Back to the Selkie. So, Manannan came here, glamoured as Flitish, brought you with him, visited Fand, switched your appearances, and walked out with Fand? She nods.
Except I was glamoured as Perun, not my true shape.
Meaning Manannan and Fand walked out together, disguised as Flitish and Perun. They might still be glamoured that way, and be up to all kinds of mischief. And you've had no visitors since?
No.
So, Flitish doesn't know that Fan's escaped with Manannan's help, and neither does Breit. You can stay here as you are, I say. We let someone else pass judgment. I toss the key to the shackles on the floor, near enough for her to reach. Unlock yourself after I'm out. And who, I wonder, will pass judgment on me? I imagine Breit might have something to say after trusting me with keeping Fan secure. But I surely did not expect Manannan to still be so in love with her that he would spring her from prison after she tried to kill him and all his Selkies. And how did he find out she was here, anyway? I suppose it doesn't matter. If and when we find them, we can worry about it then. I toss the cold iron back to the guards when I exit the cell. You lads were suckered good with a glamour. From now on, everybody gets touch with the cold iron before they go in. Make sure you know who you're dealing with. It's a long shot, but I visit Mananon's estate just in case he's foolish enough to be there. He isn't. Place is entirely empty. Wards all dispelled. The pigs and sheep are all gone from the grounds. Not a selkie or a fairy in sight. That means they're off somewhere, plotting together. And they either have an entourage, or they kill them all to make sure no one told any secrets. Well, this is a sad sack of shite, I say, in the silent castle kitchen, once a hub of frenzied activity. We're all going to take it up the arse, and probably won't even get our pants pulled down first. My eyes spy some fine whiskey on the shelf, and I remember saying to Dr. Sudarga that all I wanted was a shot and a good long rest in bed. I pull out a glass and take the bottle down. Sleep will have to wait, but I might as well have that drink now.
Chapter 16. For the record, Shango is a really super charming thunder god. I know only the barest sketches of his pantheon, and after he spends a couple of hours telling stories about them and the beliefs of his people, I'm simultaneously enthralled and ashamed. Enthralled for obvious reasons, but ashamed that I didn't know more about the Orishas already. It's an unfortunate truth that in the Western education system, well, in the Western countries, period, we are sadly deprived of the rich variety of African traditions. So much so that many make the mistake of thinking of the entire continent of Africa as a monoculture, rather than the vast collection of disparate cultures that it is. Shango's people primarily hail from Yorubaland, which spans the southwestern portion of modern-day Nigeria into a couple of neighboring countries, Benin and Togo, though he also has worshippers scattered throughout the world as a legacy of the slave trade. A consequence of that legacy is that he and the other Orishas get out of their homeland quite a bit to keep track of their people and do the odd favor here and there. And I suspect he might be more powerful than Pirun because he continues to enjoy healthy worship from around the world. Pirun, I think, begins to feel outclassed halfway across Poland because his English is not nearly so good. He shuts up for a while, and what little expression I can see underneath his beard looks sour. I speak to him in Russian, which I'm fairly certain Shango does not speak. Are you feeling left out, Pirun? He lifts an eyebrow at me first, throwing some shade, perhaps, but then he dissolves into a sheepish grin. He replies in the same language, in which he has no fluency issues.
I suppose I am. Silly of me, I know. But we gods of older, smaller pantheons have our insecurities, too. My problems with English are persistent, and I have not devoted enough time to eradicate them. So it is my own fault if I am feeling inadequate. Please forgive my mood.
Done. But do join in whenever you feel like it. I enjoy hearing from you, too. When we get to Bydgoszcz, we have to choose whether to follow the southern or northern bank of the Wisła River to get to Warsaw. I choose the south because there are a couple of large forested swaths on the way, according to the elemental, which will allow us to make good time and not have to worry about roads and people staring at the strange group of people running as fast as a horse and hound. And besides, once in Warsaw, the Wisła River bends south, and we'll wind up on the side where I met Melina's coven before. Apart from my aching innards, I'm starting to think it might simply be a pleasant run for us as we trek through Campinos National Park, which is only 20 kilometers or so to the northwest of Warsaw. It's the especially dead time of night, around 3 in the morning, and nothing stirs to give us the feeling of an imminent attack. The attack just happens. Out of the mist clinging to the Wisła River, Three grayish figures rise and float toward us with glowing white bulbous eyes. Their arms and fingers are long and stick-like. Straight white hair streams back from their scalps. And I can't see much in the way of legs, but that might be because they're flying, so their legs are stretched out behind them. Pirun? What are those? I say. The Slavic thunder god turns and gasps.
They are Nozmitsa.
It's an unfamiliar word, and I'm not even sure what language it comes from, so I sputter, yeah, but what are they? He doesn't get time to explain, but in short order, I figure out that they're unfriendly, because one of them floats right through my defensive swipe with Skawaja and locks a cold collection of bones around my throat, bearing me to the ground with surprising strength for something so insubstantial. The same happens to Pirun and Shango, and then we all try to fight back. The trouble is, my staff and fist just whiff through the thing, though it is undeniably exerting tangible force upon me. I pull out a knife and stab into it, and watch my hand simply float through it. A hoarse, halting whisper that might be a laugh huffs out of its toothy mouth, and my windpipe closes as its hands constrict. I can't breathe, and I can't bring any force to bear on this thing. I look to the gods for tips, but they're having the same difficulty. They're being choked to death and can't lay a finger on the Nozmitsa in return. One or both of them summons winds to try to blow them away. Not a bad idea, considering their ephemeral nature, but all that does is kick up leaves and toss my hair around. I see a fireball in the sky above and understand what's happening. This is Loki's doing. The fireball doesn't descend, it just hovers, watching. He's arranged a second ambush for me, where he lets some other creature do his fighting for him. And as before, it's a carefully chosen creature, against which I have little or no defense. I can't even begin to figure out how I would bind this intangible thing if I had breath to speak the words.
Grunuel!
Orla shouts in my head as I try to think of some way to affect this strange spirit. Its bony fingers are right on top of my cold iron amulet and it doesn't care.
Let me help!
No, wait! I project to her, but Orla has already pounced on top of the Nozmitsa. I expect her to simply fall through it on top of me, but instead she lands palpably on its back. Her teeth tear into its substance, and the whispery laugh becomes a hoarse cry of surprise and slides into a scream. Orla pulls it off me, teeth embedded deeply, and shakes her head back and forth like she would with a chew toy, the instinctive attempt to snap the neck. I don't think the Nozmitsa has a spine in the traditional sense, but Orla's move shakes the creature apart into clumps of dirty vapor, and the scratchy wail fades, and the bulbous eyes wink out.
Good hound, thank you. Can you do that again, to the ones on Shango and Pirun?
Orla hacks once and says,
yes, but they taste horrible.
As she bounds over to help the gods, I check the position of the fireball, which hasn't moved, and then look around for Miwash. He's perhaps 40 yards distant, pacing and snorting in nervous agitation. I wonder again why Loki doesn't use the special weapons he's acquired for me. Where are Vayu's arrows or the whirling blade Fuilta? Perhaps neither would survive the journey in flame, and he's saving them for a special target. Odin would be my guess, and perhaps Freya. Orla dispatches the two other Nozmitsa, thus becoming the first wolfhound to rescue a couple of thunder gods. And as they get to their feet, I say, eyes to the sky, guys! It's Loki! They look up, spy the fireball, and snarl. In tandem, they raise their weapons to the sky, and the weather takes a decided turn for the worse. Loki can survive their lightning strikes, I think. He had no difficulty with Pirun the first time we met him in a field near Flagstaff. But the Asgardian decides against escalating and moves off to the north. The thunder gods don't pursue, since they're supposed to protect the horse instead of chase Loki down. But they mutter about him being a coward. I privately disagree. He's bold enough when it suits him. He simply plays the odds. Were any of us alone, he'd probably dive right in. But facing two thunder gods, plus a druid who can wink out of sight and clock him upside the head, is not an ideal scenario. Maybe it's because he's still healing from the tomahawk I put in his back. I sure hope so. After he's out of sight, I promise Orla a deer hunt soon, and go to soothe Miwash. While Shango asks Pirun what the hell those things were. I listen in, because I want to know as well.
What Nitsa are nightmares,
he says in English.
Damned souls who choke people as they sleep, leave no trace. Not usual to attack like this.
Why couldn't we touch them?
Shango asks. Pirun shrugs.
His way of nightmares, yes? They get you in clutches, and you cannot fight back, only wake. Except we already awake, so no escape for us.
Then why could Orla take them out, I say?
Any dog, even small ones, can do this to Notnitsa. They guardian against many spirits. They bark at night sometimes, and you think, what's you barking for? Stop that. Sometimes dogs hearing and seeing things we do not, and they scare them away. Protect us. Roosters do this too, but nobody like roosters, except hens. Good thing you like dogs.
Orla, is this true? Do you bark at spirits sometimes?
Maybe. I never saw one before now, but sometimes I feel something bad coming, and I bark until the bad feeling goes away. Oberon does this too.
Well, thank you.
That was not the kind of fight I hoped for,
Shango says. Loki rarely gives you that, I reply. You have to find a way to surprise him. We continue from there, much more paranoid than before, but nothing else attacks on the way into Warsaw. I lead Miwash and our escorts to the same bound poplar tree in Polomokotowski, where I assume I'll find the coven, but it's only Melina herself.
An hour before dawn is a hell of a time to return victorious, Granuel,
she says, shivering in the cold.
I couldn't believe the divination when I saw it, but since it is victory, I'll forgive you.
She grins in wonder at Miwash.
Wow, the white horse of Shventovit. Did you have any trouble? Oh,
her eyes drop to my blood-stained shirt.
I see that you did.
Yes, plenty. But I'll be all right eventually. Getting slammed to the ground by the Notznitsa had not done my injuries any favors. I would be an utter wreck without Gaia's continuing aid.
And these gentlemen are?
Melina asks, looking at Shango and Pirun. I'm not sure that I should introduce them as such. Hired muscle, I say, and hope the lie isn't utterly obvious on my face. I suppose it might be technically true in Shango's case. He'd said something about Odin wanting him to help me give Loki the finger on this one, and maybe he paid in the currency of his favor. Not that Shango would give a damn about favors from Odin. Regardless, they're keeping their distance, signaling that they feel no need to be introduced, and I respect that. They don't talk much, and they'll leave once the horse is safe.
Right. We should get going, then. We'll take him to my place. The house and all the land surrounding it is warded.
Warded how, if I may ask? I mean, against what?
Well, fire, of course. Loki will not be burning everything around him like he did in that onion field.
What about demons and spirits? Melina smirks.
No problem. If they get past our wards, we have hell whips for those. You can relax. We channel the powers of the Zorias, and they are protective goddesses. We know how to protect our homes.
I figure that must be true. If Odin is fine with Miwash staying with the sisters, it must be as safe as any place he could find in Asgard. Melina had seen we'd be arriving on foot, of course, so she rode her bike to the park.
We have to cross the river, so it will be a few more kilometers. I suppose your early arrival is good for something. We'll have the streets practically to ourselves.
She leads the way, blonde hair resting on a red coat, and we follow through a city getting its last few minutes of sleep. It's slower going, since so much of it is paved, and I have to run without any juice from the earth. The sun isn't above the horizon, but the eastern sky is lightened from pitch to merely gloomy by the time we cross the Viswa River. There's a genuine ray of sunshine announcing the dawn when we turn onto Ulica Lipkowska in the Radosht neighborhood of Warsaw. It's quite nearly bucolic. Fenced properties on an acre or two, mixed in with wooded areas. Pines grow there, since the soil is somewhat sandy on that side of the river, and the pines send their roots deep enough to hold on. Once in the canopy of the neighborhood, the urban hum fades, and you don't think that you're only 5 minutes away from a city of 2 million people getting ready for Christmas or assorted pagan good times. Birun and Shango take their leave at the gate Melina's property. They summon winds and lift up into the skies, and once they're clear of trees, Shango flies south and Pirun heads north. It blows their cover pretty spectacularly.
Kayed muscle, eh?
Melina says, her tone drier than a week-old bagel.
Yeah, but also thunder gods. I forgot to mention it. Sorry, I thought you would know already.
I only divined your arrival with the horse, she says, opening the padlock on the gate.
It looks like a perfectly normal lock, but a quick flip to the magical spectrum confirms that there is a whole bunch of hoodoo surrounding it. There are also layers of protections ringing the entire fence and arcing over the property in various shades of purple, from lavender to deep violet. I'm sure that while I lived in the same building as the sisters in Tempe, their floor of the tower looked like this, pulsing with warning.
Melina Sokolowska's funky white house sits behind a brown slatted wood fence that encloses the whole acre and a half, and the architecture is old school. I can tell by the popped-out windows with triangular tiled hats on the second story, and the giant casements for the first-floor windows are giveaway too. I'm guessing it was built in the 1930s. There's moss growing on the wide stone steps leading up to the main house, and a smaller set leads to the door of what must be either attached servants or guest quarters. Most of the coven is outside waiting for us on the steps, bundled up in coats and purple scarves, sipping thermos cups of tea or coffee held in their gloved hands. Their smiles are wide and genuine when they see Orla and me. Berta bounces up and gives me a hug, and then asks if I would like some cake.
I knew you were coming, she says. So I baked you one.
That would be great, I tell her. But I'd like to make sure that Shventovit's horse is happy first. To the wider group, I announce, his name is Miwash. A couple more witches emerge from the house, and then the entire coven steps forward, grins on their faces for introductions to the horse. He shies a tiny bit at the crowding, but I send soothing thoughts to him and explain that these women will be taking care of him now and protecting him from the god who branded him. There will be apples and oats, and he'll be able to take walks in the woods and enjoy the sky from now on. He already knows Melina, and introductions to the other four witches I know proceed quickly. I point out Roxana, Berta, Claudia, and Casimira, and they say hello to Miwash. Melina darts inside the house to get me a fresh shirt and light jacket for the chill. I have to slow down and take my time after that, switching my head into recording mode. Formally meeting the rest of the coven will be news for Atticus when I catch up with him. He signed a non-aggression treaty with the original five shortly after he took me on as an apprentice, and these new coven members are not technically bound by it. You'll want to know who the free agents are, and I have to remind myself that I am not bound by that agreement either. And neither are any of the sisters when it comes to me. When they are smiling and welcoming like this, it's difficult to remember that we aren't really friends. Maybe they would like to be, though. I think Melina is a very different leader than the old one, Radomiwa. Her new witches all appear to be in their 20s, but that doesn't mean anything. I'm 34 now, but still look like I'm in my 20s. Martina is a brunette with bangs, and has the rest of her hair tied back in a ponytail. She has piercing blue eyes, rimmed in thick mascara, and sharp, thin lips she's painted blood red.
"If you'd rather not have that heavy cake," she confides to me, "I made some delightful cookies."
Her eyes dart to Berta, and her lips turn up on one side. Berta's eyes are narrowed, and it's evident that there's a friendly competition going on to see who can first foist her baked goods on the druid.
"Hi!"
The next witch says, bobbing her head once and smiling at me.
"I'm Evelina."
Her bubbly greeting is a stark contrast to the Swedish death metal t-shirt I see peeking out underneath her jacket. She has hot pink streaks in her black hair, multiple piercings in her eyebrows, a ring in her nose, and a stainless steel stud underneath her bottom lip. Unlike the others, she has no purple scarf, but she wears dark purple eyeshadow instead. She throws up some horns with her fingers, as if she's at a Dio concert, and nods once.
"Rock on!"
I think that might be all the English she knows, and that's fine. Her smile goes a long way, and her few words of English are more than I know in Polish. Agnieszka looks somewhat colder and more nervous than everyone else. Her violet scarf is wrapped around her to such heights that her mouth is completely hidden. I see only her prominent nose and eyes above it, like an old Kilroy graffiti from World War II. She has purple mittens on her hands, which I notice when she extends one to shake mine.
"I'm not very good at baking, or anything normal, really,"
she says, apologies in her tone.
"But I'm quite good at words, if you need anything like that."
"That's very kind, thank you." Next, a blonde witch, who spent a lot of time in the sun, introduces herself as Dominika. She's shaven the right side of her head down to her ear, but let the top and left side grow straight and long, in a sort of homage to new wave styles of the 1980s. Her exposed, perfectly shaped right ear has 8 different piercings with beautiful rings and studs, and when I begin to stare at it, I realize that it's what she uses to charm people. Wow, an ear witch. I blink furiously and look at her eyes, which are shining with excitement.
"I love horses," she says. "Will you tell Miłosz I'm so glad he's come to stay with us? He is magnificent."
I relay these sentiments to Miłosz, and he nickers in response to the flattery. Dominika pulls an apple out of her coat pocket and asks, "May I give this to him?" "Of course." She moves it under his nose, presenting it on top of her palm, and he nabs it with his lips and then crunches down with evident satisfaction. Magdalena has a giant mane of dark hair that frames her head and hides her neck so that her very pale face appears to float in black waters. Her complexion, combined with that hair, remind me uncomfortably of the Morrigan. But it's not her hair that she's using to charm people. She uses her eyebrows, shaped into graceful arches, and an uncanny ability to raise either of them independently, or waggle them around. Casting eyes sideways at Berta and Martina, she says to me,
"You should not be eating cakes or cookies. Scones are best."
"Oh, you've made scones then?" Her right eyebrow lifts heavenward.
"No, I can't bake for shit, as you Americans say. I just have strong opinions about breakfast. We should not be feeding you cake and cookies as the sun is rising. You need meat and cheese, and if there must be bread, then a scone."
"Oh, I like this one,"
Orla says. Zofia is the definition of petite. I'm not sure she's fully 5 feet tall. Her hood is up, fringed in white fur, and a thick braid of auburn hair spills out of it and falls down to her chest. She nods and says only,
"Pleased to meet you,"
in a thick accent. I think, like Evelina, she is reserved because of language, rather than because she has nothing more to say. Patricia is either the daughter of immigrants to Poland, or one parent is not ethnically Polish. Her complexion is russet brown, and I'm sure she's asked constantly about her heritage, so I don't ask. It doesn't matter anyway. She's dressed in winter running clothes and wearing a pair of those abnormally bright running shoes, so I'm guessing she likes her exercise.
"Did you really run all the way here from Germany?" she asks.
"I did. I had help, though. Gaia provided most of the speed and energy." The last witch, with deep-set eyes, a narrow nose, and brown hair chopped evenly at her shoulders, approaches with a gift-wrapped rectangle in her hand.
"I'm Anna," she says. "This is for you."
"Oh, thanks, Anna," I say, taking it from her and unwrapping the package. It's a collection of poems by Wisława Szymborska, both in Polish and English, side by side. "This is perfect, thank you."
"We thought it would be a nudge in the right direction," she says. "We will help you all you want with the language, you know."
I'm genuinely looking forward to it. With introductions complete and a few more apples offered to Miłosz, we lead him around the side of the house, which is a strip of property wide enough to drive a car through, and that's by design, I see, since there's a garage tucked in the back, out of sight from the street. There's also plenty of room for Miłosz in the rear of the property, easily a full acre if you subtract the house, though I notice that the fences are further screened with cedars and evergreens. Melina returns with a shirt and jacket for me, sees where I'm looking, and says,
"Yes, we have privacy around the perimeter. And a little farther on you'll see that the canopy of that oak and willow provide an aerial screen as well. That's where we do all the outdoor rituals."
I spy a fire pit, a bona fide cauldron hanging above it, and a makeshift altar underneath the trees.
"What kind of rituals would those be?" "Like your divination cloak. We'll get started as soon as you're ready. You've certainly held up your end."
"Oh, I'm ready. Let's do it. But let me ask Miłosz first if he needs anything." Sending images along with my words, I ask him, "Do you need water or food?" I get the sense that he wouldn't mind some of both, and I turn to Dominika.
"He'd like something to eat and drink." "Great. If he'll follow me, I'll show him where we'll be keeping him."
"Follow Dominika, tan person with blonde mane," I tell him, pointing to her. He obligingly clops after her, and she giggles a bit.
"It's so cool that you can talk to him. Druids are awesome."
"Thanks. So are witches."
"Save me a spot in the circle, sisters," Dominika says. "I'll be there as soon as I finish with our handsome guest."
Agnieszka guides me over to the fire pit, where there are some glowing coals from earlier. She instructs me to sit in a very specific spot between the fire and the altar, facing north. After checking my position, she coaches me to scoot over a minute amount, then tells me not to move once the ritual begins.
"The more still you are, the better the cloak will adhere."
Patricia throws some kindling on top of the coals and coaxes the fire to life again. Berta and Martina stand next to the altar and begin chopping up bundles of herbs they'd already laid out for the purpose. Evelina hauls over a bucket of water and pours it carefully into the cauldron. When she finishes, she looks up and catches me watching her. Her teeth flash at me, and she throws up the horns.
"Rock on!"
The rest of the witches stand around me in a circle, with gaps for the others to take their places later. Melina kneels down next to me to explain what will happen.
"The true nature of our divination cloak is really a blessing bestowed upon you by the Zorius. With their help, we are going to hide you from the second sight, the third eye, the fourth horseman, the fifth element, the sixth sense, the seventh sun, and all other seers, deities, and methods of extrasensory perception."
I have so many questions after hearing that list, but the one thing I really want to ask about is the fifth element. I keep my mouth shut, though, because I don't want to lose any druid wisdom points, And it already sounds like they're giving me the equivalent of a multi-pass?
Once this blessing is bestowed, Melina continues, it can be removed, as your Indian friend removed the cloak from Mr. O'Sullivan's sword. But it will require a skilled practitioner of the magical arts and ritual. It's not something you can cancel easily.
Understood. But what about cold iron?